Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hey, you and out there, ladies and gentlemen, this is Tim Banal with BanalofAmerica.com. Welcome to yet another edition of Banal of America Audio, Season 1. I want to thank everybody who checked out the Jim Mars season premiere over the last couple weeks. I'm just totally amazed at the downloads and feedback we got on this. And I hope you stick around and enjoy the rest of Banal of America Audio Season 1. Tonight, we feature Marshall Klarfeld, author of Atom, The Missing Link. I lay out Marshall's bio in the interview, so we'll skip right ahead to the actual interview this week. This interview was conducted on August 5th, 2005, with Marshall Klarfeld, author of Atom, The Missing Link.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest this week is Marshall Klarfeld. He's the author of Atom, The Missing Link. Here's a little bit about him from his website. I'm sure he's going to give us some more background anyway when we talk. As an undergraduate student at Caltech in the late 1940s, Marshall was fascinated by the advanced scientific knowledge found in the Bible story of creation. Genesis describes the creation of our solar system as occurring in a six-day time frame. His question was, how did this 5,000-year-old Bible description of the birth of our solar system disclose the advanced scientific information? The ignition of our sun occurs at the fourth day in a six-day creation process, thousands of years before we discovered it. Uncertain how to unravel this puzzle, he questioned his Nobel laureate professors, Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman. Their powerful answers stayed with him for decades and inspired him to pursue the knowledge that he is now able to share with the readers of Atom, The Missing Link. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Marshall Klarfeld to Banal of America Audio.
Thank you, Tim. That was very precise.
Well, why don't you give me a little bit of your background before you got into this area of research?
Okay, I entered Caltech in 1947, which was kind of an auspicious year because Roswell occurred just across the state lines. And the words UFO came into our language at that time. I spent 4 years, graduated in 1951, went on into the 30-year career in industry, working for Wallace Johnson up in Berkeley with a company called Upright, and then retired. Found out that I wasn't the retiring type, so I, after traveling extensively in the Pacific Rim, got into real estate. Then I decided that my real passion in life, Tim, was to find answers to these questions that have been haunting me ever since my formative years in college at Caltech. And there were all kinds of questions that I didn't know the answers to. And as I researched, I found the Internet was a wonderful instrument. It just really was able to produce answers to things that before then I was, you know, I could spend hours in a library, but on the Internet you can find things pretty quickly. Ran into the works of Zachariah Sitchin. And Zachariah Sitchin, I read all 9 of his books after I discovered him and most of his articles, gave enough information that the pieces started to fit together. And once I saw the mosaic forming up and kind of making sense to me, I said, well, now, how do I prove this? Here's a guy who's got a theory, and it seems like it works. We were genetically engineered, basically, is what his theory says. So I proceeded to try to find the physical facts that would verify the theory. And they're right here on planet Earth. I went around, as I say, doing my investigative research and put together a series of artifacts, texts, and what I'd call a way to handle the information. I created what, to me, I don't know if it's ever been done before, was a theory of information transfer. And what I mean by that, Tim, is that all the things that I was encountering had information stored in them, but they need to be put into categories. So I started with the first one, which I called SIT, stored information text. I called that the information coming out of the cuneiform tablets.
Okay, yeah.
This was information that was being stored in text form. The second item was the cylinder seals. They fascinated me. These little stone engraved devices which you could pat out on wet clay and roll the cylinder across the wet clay, and you get a positive kind of picture story. And that's a device, a stored information device. So I call that the SID, stored information device. And then I went on to the pyramids, and I call those stored information structures, SIFC. And then stored information sculptures. In those four categories, I was able to take and look at all the information that I was gathering, and then I decided to write a book.
You used decision work for your research. What other sources did you find that you were looking into? Some of the von Daniken stuff. I don't know.
I read von Daniken, but I really, you know, besides, I tried to verify the translations of Sitchin. In other words, I was skeptical of what one man was saying the thing said, and then I did some research on the Sumerian language, which is what the original tablets were written in. And I found out, Tim, that it's a peculiar language. Sumerian is unlike any other language that exists on our planet. It's the first written language, and it is subject to, you know, a variety of translations. So I investigated four or five other people who had translated, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I used that as my kind of yardstick.
Okay, yeah.
And I found out that they pretty much said the same thing. Now, Sitchin claims that he had translated over 2,000 tablets that dealt with the early formation of our solar system and the creation of mankind. These were texts that he's published in various books, and I found them to be very fascinating. In fact, I quote him quite often in my book, if you've read it.
I've taken a look at it.
Yeah, you'll notice that when I see an artifact that matches up with a tablet translation, I put them together in the book. Now, the book is not like most complex scientific journals that tell the story. I've reduced it into kind of an 8.5 by 11, like Life magazine format. So it comes out and has a bunch of pictures, like probably 145 pictures with a little bit of text explaining what the pictures mean.
Yeah, I took a look at the book, and I was actually really impressed by that because when I was thinking, I saw one of the pictures had the, I'm not sure what exactly it was. It was stone, but it had it looked like a helicopter on it.
Yeah.
You know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's on the Egyptian temple at below Cairo. It's kind of an interesting artifact because it shows not only the device that looks like a helicopter, it also shows what was the Ark, which is kind of like a submarine.
Yep, yep.
And then it shows a glider, which could be a space shuttle. And all of these images, which are over 3,000 years old and, you know, found on this ceiling of this temple in Egypt, seem to me to say, well, you know, what were they looking at? Yeah, the folks that were sculpting this thing, Tim, had to see something that looked like that. And I'm not sure those are exactly what they were, but I was fascinated by the submarine with the snorkel stem on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Sitchin's theory is that the flood was a tsunami. You know, that it came from the South Atlantic when the ice shelf got sent in there by the passage of Nibiru that came through one time and shoved this huge amount of ice into the ocean, causing this huge tsunami. And an ark wouldn't survive floating on top of the water. It would have to be kind of a submersible design to actually survive that kind of a event.
And and people who are listening right now, actually, they can see the picture we're talking about. It's on the preview. You can preview the book at adamthemissinglink.com. So
yes.
If they're wondering what we're talking about, they can actually see the picture. So that might be helpful.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that because I did make available about five or six pages that they can click. There's a little button on the bottom of the picture of the book, Adam the Missing Link, and when you hit that, you get inside the book and see 3, 4, or 5 pages.
Yeah, so people who are like, what are they talking about? They can go and check it out now while they're listening to the audio, which is always nice. And what I liked about that part of the book, and I'm sure the rest of the book too, is that with a lot of these textbooks, you can't, you know, you hand someone a book, you don't know if they're going to read it or not. You know, they might skim it. Well, this book with all the pictures, you can actually show someone and say, look at this, you know. Look at here, how you explain this, how you explain that, instead of expecting them to read. People are lazy. They're not going to read nowadays.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And thank you for mentioning that, Tim, because that's part of my design. My design of getting this information out, which is, you know, some of it is a repetition of what Sitchin has said. Some of it's new that I've discovered. But the whole idea is to keep the dialogue going. This is a story that needs to get worldwide attention. It just is crying to be learned and taught in schools. Now, this big debate going on in the cover of Time magazine this week that's going on in our schools is, what do we teach our children? You know, and most of the argument that's going on is between evolution and ID, which is called intelligent design, and that's kind of another way of saying creationism, what the Bible says. So we got the story of the Bible, and we got the story of what Darwin wrote in his book, and the science folks in the schools say, you know, they only want to teach proven scientific things, and you can't prove religion. That's the Bible part of it. Well, I'm saying that this story of Adam the Missing Link, the story of genetic engineering as it unfolds in my book, is really what should be taught, because it shows that each side on that argument is half right. You know, the evolutionists are half right and the creationists are half right. But the true facts, and when I asked some of these science teachers who are in the Kansas area, the debate is really hot in Kansas.
Yeah.
I said, well, how do you tell your kids who built the pyramids? I mean, you know, there's a scientific creation. It's one of the most magnificent structures on the planet. And we don't know how to explain who built it. Well, if you take the story of genetic engineering and the facts that I show in my book, Adam the Missing Link, you'll get a possible answer. I'm not saying, you know, exactly that's the way it happened, but it's the closest thing, Tim, that I could find.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you say you present some of the Sitchin stuff and some new stuff, so why don't you let me know a little bit about what this new stuff is.
Okay.
You know, you don't have to give away the whole farm here, but give, you know, let us know.
Oh, no, that's all right.
You know what I mean.
I know. One of the things that fascinated me was, why were the pyramids built? Well, in the text they said they needed a beacon for navigational purposes. When they were orbiting the Earth and coming in, they had the twin 12,000, 17,000-foot Mount Ararat peaks that were snow-covered all year round. But they needed an anchor for that in Egypt, Cairo area. There wasn't anything, so they decided to build these two huge mountains. Actually, they were twin mountains, which would replicate the twin mountains at Mount Ararat. And if they covered them with highly polished stones that glistened in the sun, they could line up the line between the two pyramids and the mountains of Turkey. Okay, so taking that as a base, I said, okay, they must have had some other problems. Now, if you go to page 36 in the book, you'll see how I got into this. It's the Easter Island story. And there's a little picture there on page 36 that shows the Earth with its dark side and its light side. And if you're orbiting around the equator in your ship, you go from the light side of the Earth to the dark side of the Earth. And then if you look at the map of the Earth laid out just below that, and you've seen this at NASA's Houston Space Center, they have these lines that go up and go down. It's kind of a sinusoidal curve.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you see, because the Earth tilted on its axis, and as it spins under you and you're going around it, your path of sight follows this sinusoidal curve.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, when the pyramids go dark, what's the light that they've got? And I looked at the Easter Island statues, and they all face east. And they're all kind of replications of the, what the Anunnaki look like, according to cylinder seals. And their heads are tipped up, and they have polished coral eyes.
Ah.
And these 900 pairs of eyes looking up in the east that will reflect the sun. And believe it or not, Easter Island is 12 hours from Cairo, where the pyramids are. So that they would be in the daylight when Cairo's in the dark.
Yeah.
And it made sense to me. I said, you know, why were these statues put on an island in the middle of nowhere? I mean, that island is 2,000 miles from anything. Absolutely. But it works as a beacon. So then I started thinking about beacons. And I said, there's got to be some other beacons that will give them direction as they're coming in. Because, you know, unlike it is today, they didn't have the ability of a infrastructure full of telescopes and radio signals that they could use. The Earth had nothing on it at the time they were using it. So I found a place called Newgrange, which is in Ireland. Well, first I had Stonehenge. Stonehenge is on page 21, and Newgrange is on page 38. Now, Newgrange, the Anunnaki, by the way, the Anunnaki is what the Sumerians called these folks, and I guess they called that themselves, too. So in the Bible, there's a reference to a group called the Nephilim. And the Nephilim were described in the Bible as those who came from heaven to earth. And the Sumerians, who were the first recorded civilization on our planet, called them the Anunnaki. So if we use that word, your audience will understand what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
These are the extraterrestrials who came to this planet 450,000 years ago and started doing their thing. Well, when they built Stonehenge, Tim.
Yep.
On page 21, you'll see the original, there weren't any stones. All it was a big circle, a trench really, with 56 3-foot diameter chalk holes. They eventually became the Aubrey holes, because this guy John Aubrey discovered them. But they reflect. In other words, if you had a circle of 56 stones, and by the way, if you filled the trench with water, and you look at it from the sky, it's black. Water reflects is black from up above. So you get a black circle with 56 white dots reflecting upward. And similar at the same time was Newgrange. Newgrange was an astronomical device which also had a highly reflective surface. That's on page 38. And if you draw a line between Newgrange and Stonehenge, guess what? It intersects the line from the pyramids to Mount Ararat at Baalbek, which is where the landing platform was.
Very interesting.
I'm an engineer. You know, that's what I studied and graduated as. And I look at things perhaps a little bit, I'm a tire kicker.
Yeah.
And I want to get a hold of something. I want to see what it's made of. I want to see how it works. And everything I've looked at in my research on this entire project has been approached in that fashion. Why was this done? How does it work?
Yeah.
And what I just described to you was a little bit of extra information that came up. Now, by the way, there's another piece of it.
Okay.
In France, at a place called Carnac, which is on the coast of France.
Mm-hmm.
There are over 3,000 stones in a line, or in several lines. And if you look down at it from above, the position of Stonehenge and Newgrange connected with, I mean, the line between them is what gets you to the Baalbek. But offset is the same offset as the Orion belt configuration. Now, the pyramids at Giza have that same configuration. There's two big ones and one little one.
Yeah.
And it's cocked at an angle between the two that are in line. And I'm guesstimating that maybe they did that for that reason, to try to fulfill every place else they did it. In the Mesoamerica, when they built the pyramids there, they did the same thing. you know, two big ones and then a little one off at an angle, which was the configuration of the Orion Belt. Now, the other thing that you ask is, you know, what else did I discover? If you remember the page that showed the Pioneer plaque?
Well, I've seen the Pioneer plaque, so I haven't seen the page
yet. It's on page 9 in my book. There's a depiction of what we look like and the number of planets that we are and where this spaceship came from. But off on the left, Tim, there's a starburst design. It's actually a three-dimensional map of our solar system. Not just our solar system, but the galaxy that we're in, which is the Milky Way. And it's pointed on the 14 pulsars. If you took the 14 pulsars and intersected them, that would show where our little sun and its nine planets at that time were. So I said, why did Carl Sagan and his guys do that? They also did it on the Voyager 1 and 2 records, the gold records. They put that same starburst map. And I said, well, I guess they wanted to speak in a language that somebody who would look at it could understand, okay?
Yeah.
All right. We go to the Nazca plane where the lines, everybody's, including von Daniken, remark about. And on page 49 in my book, I discovered and had reproduced the starburst configuration exactly like the one that we sent out into space. And I said, well, now, here is a map, a three-dimensional star map, perhaps showing where they came from. And I show that at the bottom of page 49. And I don't think anybody hooked that up ever before.
Now, I remember you saying that Carl Sagan, the first, was he the one that designed the plaque, right?
He and his group, yeah.
Yeah, and you said the first language they used was Sumerian?
Yes, that was on the records, on the gold records on Voyager.
Yeah.
And they had 55 languages saying hello, you know, so
yeah.
That they could. And the first language they used was Sumerian, which is a 6,000-year-old language that's not spoken anymore. And I said, yeah, I wonder why they used that language.
Exactly, that's what I was just about to ask you. Why do you think that was, why do you think they did it?
Okay. There's a problem we have with our scientific community, Tim. You've probably run into this before. They're kind of in a closet.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to come out. You know, they're afraid that what their peers will think of them if they say something or do something that recognizes that this is perhaps a story that they should be researching and talking about, but they haven't. And I think Carl Sagan maybe knew that, and he, because of his popularity, said, well, we're going to do this, and they did it, and nobody thought about it, but he was saying he knew. It was a way of him saying he knew.
Yeah.
But he wasn't coming out of the closet. And also, by the way, in one of his stories, I think it was one of the books he wrote, Contact?
Yeah.
His spaceship is called Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting to speculate on these things, Tim, but
He may have been tipping his hand a little bit.
A little bit. And then there's a picture of him that I reproduced in the book, standing against the building, and over his left shoulder is the depiction of the 10th planet. It's the winged globe.
Ha, really?
Yeah, that's on the back of Contact. So, you know, he pictured the author on the back of the book, and there he is with over his left shoulder is the 10th planet.
Ha.
So, I don't know. This is speculation on my part. I can't prove it. But I'm really on a kind of a mission, you might say, to get the scientific community to come out and start talking. Now, I just saw a movie. It's by a guy named Timothy Ferris, and I'm going to contact him. He's a physics professor up at the University of California, Berkeley.
Yeah.
And it's a PBS home video. It's called Life Beyond Earth. I'd recommend renting it and looking at it, because in it he has some beautiful pictures of how the universe works. But more important, he has 7, 8, 9 top scientists talking about, yes, there is life out in the universe. All we have to do is make contact with it. In other words, they're all talking about this, in fact, the one gal that's in there is Frances Cordova. She was the chief scientist of NASA.
Oh, really?
And she's about 40 years old, and she's just charming, and, you know, along with these other heavy-hitting scientific people, every one of them, Tim, says, yes, there is life out there. The law of probability says there is. And that's, of course, what Feynman told me when I asked him that way back. Now, my question to them is, what makes you think they haven't already been here?
Exactly.
It's only 450,000 years ago. That's nothing. All of these other systems that this life exists on are millions, billions of years older than we are. And their technology's got to be, you know, gazoos beyond us. So what's so impossible to imagine that if you have the proof here and you see all these things that you can't explain, that they've been here, that this story is true, that we were genetically engineered. I mean, after all, we're going to do it ourselves.
Exactly.
Very, very close to doing it right now.
Why don't you, for the people that are just completely clueless to the whole ET progenitor concept, why don't you give a thumbnail sketch of what exactly that is? I'm sure there's people listening who are sort of trying to wrap their head around this that haven't actually had it spelled out for them.
Okay. Here's the way it goes. Just as concise as I can put it. this is according to the story that they wrote. This is there. 450,000 years ago, travelers, space travelers, from a planet that already exists in our solar system called Nibiru, that's the name of their home planet, was captured billions of years ago. It was floating free in space, and Neptune's gravity caught it and brought it in, and it became part of our home system of planets. They had a problem. Since they have an atmosphere and they had their own generation of heat from their internal system on the planet, they had a hole in their atmosphere, Tim, and the hole was leaking everything out. And they tried everything to close it up, and they couldn't close it up, and they finally decided that the one thing that would close it up are flakes of gold. And didn't have any gold on their planet, so they took a survey of the solar system that they were in, found Earth as the gold, came to Earth 450,000 years ago, started mining the gold, and sending it back to their home planet to close the hole. Now, my nearest thing to that is that all of our astronauts have visors, and on the visors they have gold. It's a gold coating, and you flip the visor down and totally keeps the sun, reflects the sun out. So if you put flakes of gold in the hole in your atmosphere, enough of it, you could reflect the sun out and close the hole. Huh. Anyway, that's the story, and about 200,000 years ago, there was a mutiny amongst their workers who were digging in these African mines, which are 2 miles deep, and we're still digging in those mines today, 2 miles deep, and it's not easy to do. It's hard work, it's hot, and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
They said, not digging anymore. And so the solution was either to abandon the project and, you know, lose their home planet and come here and live, or one of the leaders said, we could make a worker here. There are, you know, there are all these hairy creatures that are around us. There's the Homo erectus that was existing on Earth at that time. We put our mark on it. We can make a primitive worker. So they did. They described the experiments that they went through, genetically engineering the eggs of the Homo erectus female. And, you know, I can go into great detail on that, but I won't. They finally achieved their first successful genetic engineered new species. Now, this was against the prime directive. They knew that they shouldn't be met, but it was a matter of survival for them. If they did not do this, they couldn't survive on their home planet. So they created us. They created humanity by jump-starting Homo erectus, putting some of their DNA into the eggs of a female Homo erectus and producing what they called Adamu. The first successful human was Adamu. And the story went on that, you know, they created lots of them, and then they solved their problem.
And now, did they leave? Did they leave Earth after?
Okay.
You know, what happened?
Fast forward.
All right. I didn't know if you were.
No. Actually, the humans produced themselves. They were able to genetically engineer, because clones cannot reproduce themselves. They're sterile. So that they had to tinker with the anatomy again to make humans be able to produce themselves, because they were being produced by the Anunnaki females. They were birth mothers. And the language that the birth mothers were talking to these babies that they were producing was Sumerian. So I think that the Sumerian language is the Anunnaki's language. That's the way I figured that out. But anyway, we became very populous. We thrived, and there was a flood. The whole flood story, by the way, is told in my book by the first printed story that ever appears on our planet is the Epic of Gilgamesh, and the 11th tablet of that 12-tablet story is the story of the flood. And I use that because I think it's an excellent insight into how they transferred information to us. But once they got to the point where they had gotten enough gold and they had, saved their planet, we had advanced to a certain point where they were helping us. They had technology transfers. An example of that, Tim, is the Sumerian civilization 9,000 years ago appears with all these firsts. And the anthropologists are not able to explain to anybody how all that happened. Well, if you just understand that there was a more advanced civilization parallel to ours that gave them all this information and materials, it makes sense. So I think what happened maybe 2000, maybe 1200 BC, they felt that we were successfully started because they had been told that their destiny was to come to this planet to create us, and it was our destiny, mankind's destiny, to inherit this planet. In order to inherit the planet and handle it, they had to have given us certain informations, which they did. So my guess is that they phased off the planet because they didn't need the gold anymore, and they didn't need to be interrelated with us. Now, there was a problem, Tim.
Yeah.
Huge problem. They'd been here for so long that there was some of them on the mother planet, and they were saying that you can't come back. If you come back, you're going to die because you've adjusted to a different habitat.
Yeah.
And, there's many more facts to that story, which I put into the book so that people can understand the whole concept of how we were created, why we were created, and what they did while they were here. And I tell you, this is kind of another thing, Tim, that maybe you've caught on to, too, is that if we have their genes, and if we are kind of like them, and in effect, they're our ancestors,
yeah,
we act very much like they did.
Yeah.
If you read some of their exploits, they were warlike people. They fought in clans, and they had this incredible sexual appetite.
That sounds like a human race for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you said that they were told that it was their destiny to come here and to make the human race?
Yes.
Where did they get that message from?
Okay, thank you for asking that question, because it's an important part of my story. Their deity was called the Creator of All. He's the one that created the universe, or it created the universe, and they paid attention to what messages. They got dream messages from the Creator of All. And during the flood situation, when Enlil, who was the leader, said, we know this flood's coming when Nibiru comes through, because it's going to knock the ice shelf into the ocean, and these mankind is too noisy, and there's too many of them, and I want done with them. He was really into getting rid of us.
Yeah.
His brother, Enki, gets this dream message. This is all in the 11th tablet of Gilgamesh. That's why I say it's such an important story, because that's the feature of it. message comes from the creator of all that the destiny of the Anunnaki was to come to Earth to create mankind, but the destiny of mankind is to inherit the planet. Therefore, they must save them, and Enki was given the information of how to save them, which, of course, was the Ark story, you know, Noah and all the animals. But that message was something that when the flood was over and Enki and Enlil came down to see the damage, because it was horrendous what happened, and then they encounter Noah and his people on this, you know, vessel coming to rest on the mountainside, Enlil's furious. He looks, because they all swore an oath. Enlil made them all swear an oath that they wouldn't help mankind to survive. And he turns on his brother, his half-brother, actually, and he says, you know, you did this. And Enki says, oh, wait a minute. He says, I got a dream message from the creator of all, and our destiny was to come here and create mankind, and their destiny is to inherit the earth. That's why they were saved by what I did. His brother, Enlil, does a 180-degree turn. Well, if the destiny, if the creator of all said that's the destiny, we got to help him. That's, you know, and that's when all this transfer started.
Huh. So all the creation of Sumeria and everything, that, and yeah, all the information they gave us, that all came after the flood?
The wheel, music, art, astrology, astronomy. I mean, all those things existed in the early diggings around the Sumerian civilization, and everybody's saying, you know, they arrived with all their marbles.
What's the mainstream anthropologist's explanation? They just don't offer one,
they
or
can't.
Do they have a flimsy one?
I mean, it goes against every rule that they have created in how evolution takes place and how societies build slowly and how cities, you know, people form into groups and da-da-da-da-da. Now, interesting parallel, Tim.
Yeah.
There's another story when Enki gets tossed out of Egypt and goes over to the New World and forms a whole new civilization, which is the Indian civilization over there.
Okay.
The same thing happens. The pyramids are built, and all of the transfers of astronomy, astrology, writing, new writing is developed. The Mayan writing is a new writing, and the calendar and so forth. But there's one thing that was withheld in the new civilization, the New World, and that was the wheel. See, the wheel was given to the Sumerians.
Huh.
And you won't find any evidence in the New World civilizations of the Incas, the Aztecs, the Olmecs, all those folks, of a wheel.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know. I can speculate. Tell you what my speculation is.
Okay, yeah. I didn't know if it was said somewhere in the text or...
No, it's not said anywhere. It's just, I saw this and I said,
Yeah.
You can control people better if they don't have a wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a guess on my part.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Wheels cause chariots, cause wars.
Yeah, exactly.
People have become too mobile, they move around.
I've heard you speaking before, and you talked about how there's a lot of parallels in the various religions.
Yes.
To the, you know, the Anunnaki stories.
Yes, there's a flood story in almost every religion around the world, no matter where you go. Even people who don't have religions, who just have stories. There's a parallel in the flood story. Kingship. One of the things that was given to mankind was how you rule each other. And kingship was was the Anunnaki's form of government. They had kings. So they gave us that. And the interesting thing about that is that it still exists in some of the Hawaiian history, is that the way they had the top purebred leader was that you married your sister. The king had to marry his sister. And the product of that, of course, was a pure bloodline. And that's what Enlil is. In other words, in the story in my book, the two main characters from the Anunnaki are Enlil, the purebred from the sister and the father, and Enki, who was born from a concubine. Although Enki was the firstborn son, he didn't get to be the king. He wasn't in line for succession to the king because his mother wasn't his father's sister.
Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, goes goes to the history, and if you look at the current garb of the terrorists that we're dealing with in the eastern part of the world, the Islamic, and you look at the cylinder seals of the Anunnaki, how they dressed, it's exactly the same.
Oh, really?
As they're trying to flip back to the founders.
Now, how do you think the various world religions are affected by this hypothesis? Like, do you think can they coexist with this? Can they adopt it into their belief structure?
Yes. I would hope. My hope is that once they realize that we all came from the same place and that we splintered throughout history and created different forms of religion, but the origin of all the major religions in the world is the same. And what my hope is, you know, unfortunately, majority of the slaughter that has gone on in the name of my God's the right God since civilization began has been horrendous. And if we could put a stop to religious warfare, when people understand that they're all the same, that they all came from the same heritage, that the Anunnaki were our creators, and that the prophets or whatever you want to call the others who they revere and worship came from the same place. We might eventually, it's going to take quite a while, get rid of religious warfare, I would hope. That's goal number one. The second thing is that if you look at our genetic makeup, here's one of the things that you can do. You look at the human genome study that was done in 2001.
Yeah.
Again, humans are about 25,000 plus or minus genes.
Yeah.
But there's 223 genes in our profile that aren't accounted for. They have no history. They have no predecessors. And the people who did the survey are trying to figure out, well, where the hell these genes come from. Well, they came from the Anunnaki. We all have that. Every one of us on this planet are genetically connected to this lineage.
Now, touching on the religious aspect of it, now, I know a lot of this ties in with the Old Testament, and I'm sure a lot of this is probably speculation on your part here, but I'm sure you thought about how does Jesus, the religious figure, fit into all this? Do you have an opinion on what, when you strip it from the, when you strip the, you know, the religious story off and looking at it from the perspective we are, where do you think Jesus fits into this?
Well, I can give you an answer, and I will in a minute, but I want you to remember the history of the three major religions. Abraham was one of the chosen leaders that the Anunnaki selected to work for them, be a military man. His firstborn son was Ishmael, who was born from Hagar, which was Sarah's, Abraham's wife's servant. She was an Arab. So Ishmael was the firstborn son of Abraham, and then Isaac, after the covenant was made, became the firstborn son of Sarah and Abraham. So here we have Judaism, Christianity, and Islam from the same person, Abraham. Now, Jesus was Jewish. Jesus was born from Mary and a father, and he preached a form of Judaism that was very much similar to what we see today in the Old Testament. The Anunnaki were revered by the Sumerians as lords, and they. And one of the reasons that the intermarriage thing happened was that some of the Anunnaki lords coveted females of mankind and produced offspring who were giants. This kind of goes back to the history of the Bible somewhat, but also you had human females producing strong giants. In the Battle of Troy, you have the fight between Hector and Achilles. And Achilles' mother said that Achilles' father was Zeus. Zeus was an Anunnaki. So the son of a leader, Jesus was the son of God. And at that time, in the Jewish religion, they always predicted a Messiah as part of the religion, and their God was Yahweh. And if Jesus was the son of Yahweh, I'm not saying that I can prove this or that it's true at all, but I'm saying that this has happened before in history, that leaders have been produced by genetic intermarriage of humans and the Anunnaki. That's not unheard of before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happened, a new religion was born. It was based on Judaism, but it grew and became the official religion of the Romans around 300 AD. And up till then, the Romans worshipped the same 12 gods and with different names that the Sumerians did. You know, if you look through history of the characters of the leaders, I'll give an example. Enki was a water god. His brother was the leader, Enlil. Okay, we go start with the Romans. Romans had Jupiter and his brother Neptune. Neptune was the water god. In the Greeks, we had Zeus and Poseidon were brothers and leaders. So here, you know, these are the same identities down through 6,000 years of time where humanity worshipped these 12 leaders until Christ came along. And when Christ became the leader of Christianity, you know, up to that time, the only other religion with a single deity was the Jewish religion.
Now, what do you think caused the change from the polytheistic to the monotheistic? Do you think that was by design, or was that just a cultural change?
I don't know. I mean, it happened. I mean, we just got to accept it.
Oh, yeah. No, I just didn't know if you could know.
You know, and all of a sudden, these 6,000 years of revering these 12 leaders in various forms, they become pagans.
Yeah, it's a very interesting change.
Yeah, it's you know, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
Yeah,
is the Temple of Zeus in Greece. It was a statue of 75-foot tall Homo sapien, encladded in gold.
Wow,
and he was Zeus, but he was a Homo sapien. I mean, he looked like us. So what I'm saying is that we look like them, and we are part of them. They look, you know, they were depicted by whoever did them, saw them as Homo sapiens.
Now, so if Jesus was created by ET progenitors or extraterrestrials, theoretically, then that would mean that they had to have come back, because there was quite a distance between when they first created us and when they created him. So that,
Yes.
Do you have an opinion on why that would happen? At least a theory.
No, I don't. And I would say, you know, 600 years later, like 600 AD, we have Muhammad dealing with Allah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, to me, another story, and I can't tell you.
Yeah, so perhaps there was an agenda there to change something in the control mechanism.
Bear in mind, you've hit on something there, Tim, that throughout the history of my reading about through the translations of the two clans, the Enki clan and the Enlil clan, is that they were rivals for power.
Ah.
And they had a rivalry that existed, you know, for thousands of years.
So it stands to reason that, yeah, that there would be factions vying to change the belief structure of the race of people.
Absolutely. I'll give you a classic example. Sitchin refers to the atomic war of 2000-something B.C. And the evidence is Sodom and Gomorrah and the fact that the Sumerian civilization was wiped out in a fashion of Hiroshima, if you read the story of how the evil wind left the desert of the Sinai and went north and east, and you know the atomic fallout and just wiped everybody out. And they made a mistake. You know, here are some highly advanced people who have atomic weapons who should have known not to use them. They should have known about the fallout, and they destroyed the thing that they built, the thing that they were most proud of, which was the Sumerian civilization. They wiped it out. And at the end of my book, I describe the dialogue as given to us by Sitchin's The Lost Book of Enki, of how they dealt with it. And it's fascinating to, you know, imagine this horrible thing happening because they were warring. It was actually their offspring, their children, their grandchildren that caused the war, part of the clan. And it was all a battle over territory and power. Territory and power. They used us, you know, after we became the primitive workers, we became soldiers in armies. And do you remember Homer's The Iliad?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and then if you read what this guy was saying about an event that took place, which was the Trojan War, he talks about the gods and how the gods were actually playing in the background, pulling strings to cause this to happen.
Huh.
That they dazzled, what's his name, with Helen and got him to go get Helen, bring her just so they'd have a war.
Huh.
Now, Homer's saying, you know, everybody thought that story was kind of a myth. All of a sudden, they dug around in the part of the earth there, and they found Troy. They found 9 levels of Troy. They didn't find the Trojan horse, but they found pottery, Tim, with the pictures of the horse on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, to me, I'm saying if Homer said that this happened, and everybody thought it was a myth, and all of a sudden we've dug around and found some evidence of it, what's to say that what he said about the gods wasn't also true?
Exactly.
So, you know, there's all kinds of interesting angles to the story and why we are the way we are today, I think, is because we were genetically engineered to be not as powerful as they are. But here's another thing for you, Tim. I just thought of this. They're space travelers. They came here and they had to do all kinds of huge mathematical calculations to get from A to B. We could not have landed on the moon or even started our space age without mathematical capability to figure out how to do that. And if we were just the product of evolution, I don't see anything in evolution that would have given us mathematical ability. There's no need for it.
Yeah.
So we must have got it genetically. Must have gotten this ability, and it's increasing because we're researching and we're discovering, and our brains are able to comprehend, you know, the angle of impact when you come back into the atmosphere so that you don't burn up. Very important when our shuttle comes back, that all that calculation, those computers and everything work so that we don't burn up. We have to hit the right angle, and that's math. And we didn't get math, I don't think. Except by inheriting it from our gene code.
From the Sumerians, they accepted and acknowledged that their gods were from off the earth.
Oh yeah.
And obviously today that's a non-discussed concept except for in our circles of the
esoteric
research.
Right, exactly.
Now, where along the line do you think that that transition happened? At some point it became hidden. And you think, well, let's go with that first, and then I'll go with the next question. Sort of
okay, well, in the story of Gilgamesh, One of the things I point out, there's five things that the story told us, but one of the things it told us in the beginning was that there was an interface between the Anunnaki and the people of Uruk, because they were in trouble and they asked for help. And what they got from the Anunnaki was Enkidu. Now, the second thing was that Ishtar. We have a statue of Ishtar. It was found in ruins, and she's a 4,000-year-old replication of a person with a helmet that enabled her to go off the planet and up into the solar, up into the orbiting spaceship and back. In fact, the story of Gilgamesh tells about her travels back and forth. So here we're being told that that can happen. And the weapon that she comes back with is pretty powerful. It's called the Bull of Heaven. And, that's kind of an indication that when she got really mad, she had the bull blow trench holes in Uruk, in 200-foot holes in the ground, which people died into. So, I mean, there are indications of what they were capable of, and they're in the stories that were left to us. And I think it's important to look at it perhaps this way, Tim. If 100,000 years from now we take off to a new home we found someplace, and we look at everything looks great except there's something wrong, we don't want it, we're going to find something else, but there is a bunch of humanoids running around there, and they're pretty backward, and they've got all kinds of trouble. So why don't we help them? And the way we help them is we get their leader, and we give them 10 rules to live by.
Yeah.
And now that's very possible that we would do that. And that's called a transfer of technology or information that would be helpful to them. And, the story in the Bible of Moses and the Ten Commandments could be looked at in that fashion.
Do you think this was a human decision to keep the fact that the gods were extraterrestrials from the general public, or was that an Anunnaki decision, or do you think that it was just that they couldn't quite understand the concept of a being living on another planet and coming here?
Well, okay.
You follow what I mean?
I know what you're saying, and the only thing that comes to my mind is Galileo. our understanding of what's going on, like only 396 years ago, Tim, we were the center of the universe, and the sun revolved around us.
Yeah.
That was the story being told to us by the authorities in the church. And Galileo looked up through his little telescope and said, no, that's not true. We're not the center of the universe. We're just one little planet that goes around that star, that sun. And there's a huge thing out there. And guess what he got for his information telling? House arrest for the rest of his life. It was by the Inquisition, by the way. The Inquisition said, you want to recant what you said? And he said, no, I won't recant it. And he says, Copernicus was right. I'm a mathematician. This is what's going on out there. And they said, okay, bang, in the slammer, into your house, you don't come out again. So the suppression by the authorities, at that time the authorities was the Roman Catholic Church, which were scientists. They had scientists that were studying things, but this didn't quite fit what they wanted it to be at that time. So that's the story that we lived with until, all of a sudden we discovered Galileo was right. We got this problem, and whether they anticipated that, whether the Anunnaki would anticipate that that would happen, I don't know. Certainly, the evidence that we have is all we can look at.
Yeah.
What they did and what they left. And what they gave us.
Moving on to the present-day UFO phenomenon, I'm sure you know some about that. So
sure.
I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people I talk to, they're all about disclosure. I'm sure you know about that, disclosure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Their point of view is they want disclosure of the present UFO phenomenon.
Absolutely.
And obviously you want disclosure of your hypothesis.
Yes.
So what do you think... which one could come first? What do you think is the best way to go about disclosure? Would it be easier to tell the people first that the extraterrestrials were coming here, or perhaps first tell them about the your theory and decision theory of the ET progenitors, and then sort of lead them to, you know, and they may come back or something like that?
Well, yes, I would say that the story needs to be gotten out. Both stories need to be gotten out, and the fear that apparently exists that the public couldn't handle it. Now, that's been around for a long time, but I don't think that's the reason, the real reason that scientists want to prove things. The scientific method is to prove that you can replicate something over and over again, and therefore it's true. And, you know, they're finding that there's holes in the evolution theory right now. They can't prove where the DNA came from and how it could be made. That's kind of a, you know, where did the seeds of DNA come from? There's all kinds of phenomenon. I think that the people seem to believe the scientific community, Tim.
Yeah.
In other words, we're again being led by those who think they know everything, and they don't.
Exactly.
They're, you know, I'm reading about the string theories coming apart, and that Hawking's black hole theory, he's not sure anymore that that's true. And I'm seeing evidence in the scientific community that they're getting a bit flustered about what they're trying to do. Our story, the story that you've pursued and I'm pursuing, I think is a story that will eventually be accepted. It has to be accepted because it's true. And the proof of it is by all the things that are here that are, you know, pointed out in my book. And if people would just, you know, take the time to look at some of the pictures and figure out that that we couldn't do those things, then by deduction it has to mean that somebody else did.
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody else has to be the people that they talk about in the tablets, because the tablets are a recorded history of what went on, albeit written by the winners, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Come out the way they wanted to, in the apologies that they did. But our story is solid, Tim. I mean, I wrote the book because I needed to prove to myself that this was a true story.
Yeah.
Sitchin kind of gave me the framework to deal with, but I said, no, all right, how do I prove that? And everything that I've put in the book are things that I believe prove irrefutably that this story is true. And I hope people would take the time to look at the book or buy it or whatever they want to do to get the information and pass it on, because you can show your friends these pictures, and they're going to get astounded.
Exactly, yes. That's for sure. I can attest to that.
And the other part of it, you know, the UFO phenomenon, which is certainly out there, is part of it. It's part of the story, and it just needs to be given legitimacy. You know, and it's, you know, to me, the thing that I was really ticked off about in Timothy Ferris's movie that I told you about, Life Beyond Earth.
Yeah.
Is that these great scientists he brings together in this flick all say there's life out there. It's got to be. But not one of them was willing to put forward the fact that they'd already come here, that contact was made 450,000 years ago, and that we're the product. I mean, if you want evidence other than the stone things, look at us. Where'd we come from?
Yeah.
Now, we're so unique, Tim. Our species is unlike any species on this planet. And if you think that Homo erectus took 1,800,000 years to evolve to his state, which was he couldn't talk, and he hit two stones together for his tools, in 250,000 years, when we, from the time our first skeletal remains are found in Africa at the gold mines where they said they did it, we're walking on the moon. How does a species go in the short time of 250,000 years to do this? It just has to be another explanation other than evolution.
And do you think a generational change will help usher this line of thought into mainstream?
However long it takes, Tim, it'll happen. And by the way, I'm not the only one that's involved in this. It's a dialogue that's been going on now for a long time, and it'll continue to go on, and people will add to it, and there'll be more things written about it, and eventually it'll surface up to the level of national attention where it deserves to be examined. And I think the school thing might be the wedge that we could use to get the thing into the mix, because many, many school boards are wondering how they're going to resolve this issue, what they're going to teach our children. And if our children are not taught the truth, they're not taught all the facts, then we're going to have problems.
Exactly. So this is sort of an this way of thinking actually bridges the two sides.
Yeah, it brings them together, actually, because each is half right. And the genetic engineering theory encompasses both, because we did come from a species that was evolving, the Homo erectus. It's a creature. And we appeared because we were made the way we were made by, in the image of our Creator. I mean, they say it in the Bible.
So what it'll really take is a brave person to stand up and say, hey, this is, we need to consider this, because
yes,
this is the...
Absolutely, Tim. If you can find anybody at MIT there... It would be great.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay.
Now, do you work? You've been in contact with Sitchin, I understand, right? You.
Yes. Yes, I'm in contact with him all the time.
What's the extent of your work with him? Just correspondence, pretty much.
Yes, it's very interesting. He's a charming gentleman who lives in an age without a computer. He has no email. I write him letters, I talk to him on a telephone, and he's still typing on a hunt-and-pick typewriter.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, the letters, I could show you one day the letters I got from him. And I really feel, you know, part of my, I'm on another mission besides getting the story out. I want to get him a Nobel Prize.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. No, he's done so much more than some guy that I found that they gave a Nobel Prize to back in 1902. It was a German who translated a bunch of coins from Rome to tell what the history of the Romans was. I mean, that was his whole thing that got him a Nobel Prize. Sitchin's gone way beyond that. And
absolutely.
So that's another, you know, avenue of my endeavor.
And How did you even come upon Sitchin in the first place? Just through your own research?
Yes. I was desperately trying to put together my question about Genesis, which is in the front of the book. And the other thing that really bugged me was that Moses came down the mountain with horns. And that story said, I know there's something screwy about that. And there's a page in my book, you'll see it towards the end, where I show where the horn thing came from. All of the Anunnaki leaders had helmets with horns on them. They were from the astrological sign of Taurus. That was their thing. So they all emblazoned their helmets. Even Ishtar has horns on her helmet.
Huh.
And so did Anu. And if you look at the cylinder seal, VA-243, you'll see Enki and Enlil self-portraits there with horns on their helmets. Well, they made a leader out of Moses. Took him up the mountain and, you know, gave him the words. And this whole thing about him coming down with horns was a sign of leadership to me. I mean, that's my story.
And so
that was the thing that drove me to find out how this all fit together, you know.
And then you read the Sitchin books and you just got in touch with him and was he receptive to dialogue?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And he obviously stands by all the stuff he wrote and everything. And he continues further reading.
He continues lectures. He just had a meeting in Chicago and in Florida and he has a group of people that he gives lectures to. Then if you go to his webpage, www.sitchin.com,
yes,
you'll see a bunch of articles on the left-hand side of that page which deals with everything that's happened, including the recent discovery of the planet that they call the 10th planet, which it really isn't. But
oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, too, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because obviously you're dealing in the realm of the 10th planet, and this is recently the news came out that they discovered a 10th planet, even though I think that news had come out years earlier, too.
Yes,
they keep discovering
1983.
Yeah, they keep discovering 10th planets. What do you think is going on there with that? Is that they're trying to discredit the whole the real 10th planet, which we know of as
No, what's happened is that our scientific ability, Tim, has improved. You know, the two new telescopes, the Hubble and the Spencer, which is infrared is seeing much further. We're poking into the Oort belt now, which surrounds our sun, and there's a bunch of stuff in there that is hanging around that's coming out, and they're seeing it. But this is not new. This is just our science catching up with history. And my take on this is that I went back and researched the historical sightings of Nibiru. The Babylonians saw it, the Hebrews saw it, the Hindus, the Egyptians, and the Greeks. And they gave it different names. Nibiru was what the Sumerians called it. The Babylonians called it Marduk. And the Hebrews called it the winged globe. Hindus, Tetra, Yuga. Egyptians, the celestial disk, and the Greeks called it Nemesis. Now, the story of the problems that happened gravitationally when that thing comes and passes between Jupiter and Mars every 3,600 years, you notice it. You report it. It does things. And, you know, and so we have a history of civilizations that have recorded its appearance. And then we also had the 1983 stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times where they found it with their infrared astronomical satellite. So it's there. Discover Magazine cover story, November 2004, says the new solar system, and it shows Sedona, which is the one they found before they found the 10th. And then they call they have planet X, or the 10th planet, as big as Mars, and then beyond that they have planet Y halfway to Alpha Centauri. We're going to discover that our little system of nine planets is not really nine.
Yes, yeah. I might as well, I should probably ask you, because I've heard all kinds of Sitchin skeptics and wannabe debunkers, and
yes,
I'm sure you've heard them. What's your take on that? And they usually assert that he's translating wrong.
Yes. Well, that's easy to do because the Sumerian language is made up of, you know, you can interpret some things five different ways. So it's easy to make that assertion. But none of them have done the scholarship that he's done. If you read his books, the bibliographies are huge and filled with the people that he's used. And he has taken, the one thing he's done is he understands the cosmology of what they were talking about. In other words, he's able to interpret what the translations mean because he's not blinded by preconceived ideas. And as far as those who, you know, wish to defame him, you know, there are all kinds of people out there that saying, like, you know, we never landed on the moon, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't bother me. In other words, I personally, Tim, am fully satisfied that his work is magnificent, that he is on the track of what actually happened, and that my book was the proof of the things that, as he said, that I connected the dots. In other words, I took all of the factors that were involved that he's talked about, and I went and examined them, and I found other things about them that, for instance, did you know that the pyramid that has the snow-capped peak at Giza?
Do I know of it?
Well, you've seen it, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Did you ever ask yourself why those stones don't fall down?
Do I know of it?
Well, you've seen it, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Did you ever ask yourself why those stones don't fall down? Come on, give me a break.
And they just don't know how they can't make it, huh?
That's right. I mean, with all of our technology today, simple thing like a mortar, it's a glue, and they did it. Hmm. And in my book, I quote Petrie's take on that, because he was a very, very famous Egyptian anthropologist and studied everything about it, and it's the thing that amazed him the most. It was like an optician working in the scale of acres.
Yeah.
Just to fit the stones. And then to put glue in the joints. So it's unimaginable.
I know, yeah. It sounds very hard.
Well, it's one of the things, one of the many items that I refer to in my book that are proof that they were here, the Anunnaki were here, and that they left us this heritage of things that they did which had reasons to be done. Not as they had for their own reasons they did it, but they left us information. You know, the pyramid is filled with mathematical stuff.
Oh, yeah.
If you've done, you know, the studies on the circles and hypotenuse and Pythagoras and pi and phi and that stuff that was way before that was ever invented. And I believe that people will get a feeling from my book, Tim, that this is a story that's worth discussing with other people and looking at and getting the concept down, because I've kept it simple. I've made it kind of like Life magazine, and there's pictures and stories and evidence, and the evidence is overwhelming. When you put it all together, when you finish reading the book, you've got a wow.
And I would assume that would be your long-term goal for the book, was to make it an educational tool.
Libraries are ordering it now. I'm getting orders from libraries. They're in Saginaw, Michigan, and St. Louis County Library just ordered it.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, the word's getting around. So, and I'm dealing with some pretty important people in Kansas who are involved in this debate on the what to teach the kids in the classroom, and that's really what I want to get to. I want this to become not a textbook as such, but at least an item that gives them a choice. In other words, what most school boards are opting out of the battle by saying, well, let's just present both sides and let the kids decide what they want to decide. Well, if they're going to present evolution and creationism, they've got to present genetic engineering. It's absolutely key.
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
and you're helping us, Tim. I mean, you with your beautiful page and your stories of contacting the movers and shakers in the media world. In other words, you're part of the media world, and the media world is where we're going to get our power to get the story up.
Well, I do my part, you know.
Well, you do more than your part.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to thank you very much for giving me the time to speak with you and really...
Well, it's been my pleasure, Tim. I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate the chance to share the information with your audience.
And the book is Adam, The Missing Link, and the website is adamthemissinglink.com, and you can get the book through there. And Amazon, too, or no?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
No. All right. Just got our ISBN number, but we're still just at the webpage, www.adamthemissinglink.com. And there's three things. They can get an e-book download.
Yep.
They can get the hard copy, and they can also get a CD I made of the story of Gilgamesh, which is kind of a interesting item.
Nice. What, do you read it?
No, actually the CD plays like a movie.
Oh, okay.
It'll play on your computer. It's a CD-ROM, and it has the story in an understandable version. I've made it so that people can understand hopefully why we got this story. You know, he's the first action hero. He's really quite a dude. Two-thirds Anunnaki, you know, his mother was an Anunnaki princess and his father was a human, which is kind of the other way around from the way it mostly happened.
And how old are you, Marshall? If you don't mind me asking.
Not at all.
Give me a rough number. What's that?
76.
You're 76?
Yes, sir.
Wow, you're a pretty hip guy for a 76-year-old.
Well, I try to stay with it.
I'll say. I just from the phone call, if I didn't know you went to Caltech in the late 1940s, from it says in your bio, I probably would have guessed you were in your late 40s. So you were.
I try to stay young in my head. That's the only thing you can do. Your body's going to age on you, but your brain will always stay active and young if you keep pushing it.
Exactly. Well, I think you've done a lot of great work for the whole ET progenitor theory, and I think your book's really going to help out a lot.
Well, thanks. I'd like to leave you with one quote from my favorite author.
Okay.
John Gardner. Life has many chapters. Learn all of your life.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. The book is Adam the Missing Link. The website, adamthemissinglink.com. Marshall Klarfeld, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tim. Thank you.
That about does it this week for Been All of America Audio Season 1. I want to thank Marshall Klarfeld very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your continued support and work on the website. And all the great listeners out there in Been All of America Audio Land. If you're listening to this and you've been enjoying the download so far and you're into the podcast thing, I should point out that we have the podcast URL available at BeenAllOfAmerica.com. So check that out. And if you've found the audio and you want more Been All, you can simply go to BeenAllOfAmerica.com. BINNALL of America.com. Thanks for tuning in this week. Next week, Terry Hansen, UFOs and the Media. This is going to be a knockdown, drag-out conversation. It is awesome. I had a blast talking with Terry Hansen. We covered all different aspects of UFOs and the Media, and I think it's a very important edition of Been All of America Audio Season 1, so you're going to want to check that out next week. Thanks for listening. This is Tim Benall, signing off.